We've actually been dealing with this disinformation campaign about libraries long before AI came into the picture. The idea that they're no longer relevant or necessary because the sum of the world's information and knowledge is now on the internet. And that's so far from true. And it becomes even less true all the time as these platforms become enshittified and they're harder and harder to find, you know, even what they were reasonably good at finding. And so AI is the next acceleration of something that we've been combating because people with power don't want public libraries or public spaces to exist. And also they like don't know anything that's true or not true about them. So this is a form of propaganda that we are here to dissipate.
Yeah, we're spreading the anti-AI propaganda for sure, definitely.
Welcome to Politics, a show where two software developers break the fourth wall and talk about the interlacing of technology and politics. I'm Josh.
And I'm Ray. We see technologies like crypto, AI, and surveillance infecting our politics. Meanwhile, governments and the media are making out that all this is inevitable. We can't leave the future in the hands of scheming technology leaders and their pet politicians.
We're here to raise our voice and open up the space for honest, good faith discussions. To help us organize and sharpen our ideas, we've invited some interesting and highly respected thinkers to share their understanding and their research with us and, of course, with you.
Politics is where we smash the myths and get to the truth.
Ray, we need to talk about libraries.
Okay, well, let's hope we can lend an ear to some librarians.
God. Well, Ray, I'm happy to let you know that we have two librarians joining us on the show today. We have Kay Slater from Chicago. Welcome, Kay. And we have Allison Macrina from Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us, Allison. If you all wouldn't mind introducing yourself to the audience, that would be wonderful.
Sweet. I'm Kay Slater. I am a public library worker. I'm based in Chicago. I'm an independent scholar at the intersection of critical communication and information studies outside of my work in a public library. I'm a member of Library Freedom Project, and I'm also on the research network for Library Futures, which is a project out of the NYU Engelberg Center for Law and Policy.
Well, thanks for joining us, Kay. And Allison, how about you?
Thanks for having me, y'all. I am the director and founder of Library Freedom Project. We are a collective, collaborative effort of library workers focused on things relating to technology and the various exploitative nature of technology, the power dynamics inherent in it, who runs it, what kind of money funds it, how it impacts our communities. So we work together on things like political education and community organizing around these issues.
Fantastic.
Great. Well, it's wonderful to have both of you here, and thanks again. So maybe just to kick it off, how do you all see the role of libraries in society today? I guess that's been changing and evolving over the years.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot that has changed and also quite a lot that's stayed the same. You know, I think that what feels really important to me is to always recognize that books are still important in the library and books will always be important to the library, that the fundamental mission is about information sharing and information sharing in common. I think the ways that the library has expanded over the last, you know, 20, 30, 40, or even 50 years is with the inclusion of a lot more information technology. So libraries are places where people go to use computers and also to learn about how to use technology, as well as different forms of digital information access. But there are also many, many ways that the library supports community programming needs. So everything from things like story time for children to some of the classes that I mentioned already. Any way that goods can be shared in common, your local library is either attempting to offer those goods in common or at least thinking about the possibilities. And so other big ways that the library has changed is now we're seeing more resource sharing, like seed libraries, for example, or maker spaces, or quite a lot of libraries you can go and borrow a museum pass and go to a museum for free. I think those of us with far left politics, you know, it's important to recognize the contradictions here, because while it's really great that you can go to your library and get all these things, why is the library now responsible for this level of community access? It's because the public sphere in the US has been defunded so significantly, and libraries are no exception to that. And so libraries are offering all this stuff and being these community anchors while also facing a funding environment that has been in crisis conditions, I would say, for at least 20 years.
There's this dynamic too of the library is like, at least the public library historically has been thought of a place to civilize the public, has been a place to make people into like good citizens, which is problematic in many ways. And you hear a lot, maybe, I don't know, like we hear a lot at least of like, libraries as like the last front of democracy. We are the sort of the last place standing effectively, which is, again, it's sort of encouraging more work to be put onto us as workers, but also just this understanding of like, in order to enter the space of the library, you need to represent yourself as a citizen, and that the library's part of the library's role is to encourage civic participation, but in a way that is like geared towards voting, for example. And some of these things can be have a utility in terms of like broadening like local education about just like what is your local government up to, and that way you can sort of understand like what the systems are at work. But that really depends on the capacity that those library workers have to even engage in that kind of programming, and also like the rapport between the library and like local government. So like a village, for example, or a state, there's a lot of possibilities there, but it is really strange based on a lot of pressures that are very like neoliberal in nature.
Allison, from your point of view, so you're involved with the Library Freedom Project. One of the things that you mentioned doing was like political education. And are those projects kind of for librarians, for the general public, for both?
It's for both. So we see librarians, and we call them library workers in the field because we like to, and I'll tell you why, right? I mean, we use them a little bit interchangeably, but you might notice that Kay and I both say library worker. One, we like to have the word worker in there because let's be clear where our allegiances are, right?
Right.
And then the other reason is a little bit related to some of the professionalization issues about how in order to become a so-called professional librarian, you need to get this actually quite expensive master's degree. And considering that it's not a profession known for its very high paying jobs, it's not like getting a law degree where you're like, okay, well, now this opens up this new possibility for me.
Right.
No, it's just a gatekeeping mechanism. And the degree largely sucks. My library science program sucked. I didn't learn anything valuable. Most people that I know who also have these degrees feel similarly, but it also sets up an arbitrary distinction between those who work in the library who possess the degree and those who don't. So we say library worker as a form of solidarity and a flattening. I forget what you asked me because I went on a different tangent.
Well, I mean, speaking of political education, we just got a good hefty dose right there.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Yes. The political education stuff. So yes, we work with, we do political education for library workers and through library workers for the general public, for our patrons. So for the library workers, we have one thing, our flagship effort. It's a program called Library Freedom Institute. Kay just completed it. That's why they're a member of LFP now.
Yes.
And basically it's a program. It's a few months long and we go through many different aspects of the sort of problem with computer and information technology. We cover things like who are the tech CEOs and what kind of political philosophy do they have? What kind of equipment, you know, we hear a lot about, for example, like ICE and CBP surveillance in the US, but like specifically what kind of equipment do they have? How do they use it? We learn about digital security and basically, you know, swim in these waters together, do a lot of skill sharing. The idea being that if you teach library workers these kinds of competencies, they then are in a position where they have a lot of trust from the public. They're embedded in every kind of community already. They're often already teaching technology classes or helping people with their technology in some form or another. If you give them this more embodied knowledge that gets at some of these like deeper political questions, they can then be a really good resource for their community members. And so on our website, libraryfreedom.org, we have a resources page, and some of them are more specific to library workers. So it's like talking points for when you're arguing with your boss about why you don't want to adopt the new AI slop machine, or how to write a good privacy policy for your library, or to conduct an audit of your own system to make sure, you know, that like you're putting these principles into practice, as well as things about teaching the public. And then we also have material that could be for anyone that's like, you know, safer messaging communication, understanding how things like stalkerware get used, preventing doxing. You know, it runs the gamut of like any kind of issue you might have when it comes to computer technology.
Wow.
By the way, this to me is like phenomenal. So,
thank you.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, could we just like take a few minutes just to like, you're the founder of this organization. So Tell us a bit about how it got started, because to me, it's like I'm in awe of this project.
Thank you so much. That's really kind of you to say. Yeah, I started it a little bit more than 11 years ago. We kind of count the starting point of like when I got money to make it my full-time job. So January 2015 is when it became officially official. But I started doing the work about a year and a half prior to that. So I was working in a public library. I was the technology librarian. And so I was already the one responsible for our tech programming and for our public computing environment. And I was already like a bit of like a free and open source software nerd. And I was always tinkering with those kinds of things on my own. And I've always been a news junkie. And so that summer, the summer of 2013, I became obsessed with the Snowden revelations.
Right, of course, yeah.
And learned everything that I could about them and really was like, wow, this is like story of a century kind of stuff. And also it was significant for me as a library worker, because the cohort that I came into the profession with was a lot of folks who joined U.S. librarianship because U.S. librarians really strongly opposed the USA Patriot Act all the way back in 2003.
Oh.
And this was so significant because, you know, your listeners might not, you know, folks are outside of the U.S. or maybe they're too young to remember. That was not a period of time where any dissent was tolerated. Yep. So it was like, you're with us or you're with the terrorists. Everybody was wearing those stupid flag pins. It was this incredibly like jingoistic and quote unquote patriotic environment. And librarians as a group and as our professional body, the American Library Association, came out and opposed the USA Patriot Act. And I was deeply moved by this as a first year college student. And I was like, that's who I want to be with. Mm. And the connection is significant because quite a lot of what Snowden revealed were things that people who opposed the Patriot Act were concerned about different forms of mass government surveillance. Right. And so I got obsessed with the story and I thought, you know, so much of that story and the focus was understandably with like people with really high level threat models, like journalists or like international dissidents, people who might be spied on by the CIA or whatever. And I was like, okay, but what about your regular degular person who's using the public library? How does this impact their lives? And I started looking around to see, were any of my colleagues working on this, given the environment that we had of access to the public? And I also started asking my patrons, like, are you following this story? Do you care about this? Are you interested in privacy education? And they all were really interested. And so I also had a hard time finding at that point any major focus on the sort of average or regular person and what the localized impacts were, you know, besides these like really big things. And so I started teaching privacy classes in my library.
Great.
I started making changes to our technology infrastructure and promoting them like, hey, look, the library cares about your privacy. Don't you think that's good? I started working with some civil rights lawyers, so folks at the ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, to pull in some more of the like regulatory and legal environment and help understand like you know, what's happening in response to these revelations and what's happening in the courts. And it just sort of snowballed from there. You know, I had other libraries who got interested. I applied for some grant funding. I was like, wouldn't it be great if I got a few $1,000s, I could go do a little traveling around. They gave me $250,000.
Okay.
The Knight Foundation, my very first funder, gave us $250,000. And we've been pounding the pavement ever since.
Wow.
That's unbelievably awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Really inspiring story.
The point about this is like really right up to date, because the thing that Snowden revealed, the whole surveillance thing, the privacy thing, this is exactly on point for the you know, the subject of our podcast, which is like this AI, and obviously sucking all that stuff up, and now this sort of enlarged space for surveillance that we're seeing in the tech area. It feels to me like more than anywhere else, and this is, it's an amazing place for information sharing out to the public about what exactly is going on here. I wasn't aware that you guys were so active in this kind of stuff, but it feels like a sort of underground railroad type thing, or a kind of subversive kind of environment where people on our side of the fence, let's say, can actually still have power. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, thanks. You see the vision. I don't have to.
Yeah, I totally see the vision. Yeah. I mean, it's spectacular. Yeah. So, what is the typical funding setup for libraries in the States, anyway? I know you're in different states, so like maybe things are different in different environments or different institutions.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just quickly say, like, Illinois, where I live and work, is a very library-friendly state. The governor and the secretary of state are very pro-libraries, which is great. Also, the American Library Association's headquarters is in Chicago. The University of Illinois is a really big library program for master students. So the state at large gets a lot of support. I think the governor even, in fact, signed a law banning, quote unquote, banning book bans. So it's cool that we get that support, but at the same time, like, the funding is still not quite enough. So libraries are funded mostly by property taxes based on a local municipality. So that could be like a village, it could be a state or a city. But like the library that I work in is, I think, 96% funded by local tax dollars. And then there are possibilities for donations through private grants, as well as the Institute for Museum and Library Services, which is a federal agency that can distribute grants based on perceived need. So right now it's a little different, just depending on sort of what's going on with the federal government. But by and large, folks apply for grants that then they can receive as part of like research or projects within organizations. But most public libraries are this way. How much they get funded is like very dependent on how much people's homes are worth within a particular area.
Every locality is a little bit different and subject to the political machinations that are, you know, whatever that place experiences. So like where I live in Philly, it's also funded by property taxes, but we have this massively complex relationship with our right-wing state government that takes a great deal of the money that comes into the city of Philadelphia, spends it on the rest of the state, and then like makes us fight for the money that we contributed in the first place. And also, there are some times where public libraries, where like the property tax funding is earmarked specifically for the library. So like there might be a levy or something like that, where it's like, we're doing this increase and it is specifically going to the library. But quite often it's just like another budget item in a city or town local budget. And so they're competing with such highly expensive other public services like the police. And so we're not only facing like, you know, how much less money there is in the public coffers, but how much more goes to things like policing.
Since you mentioned federal government funding, did the DOGE bullshit affect that at all? Like, you would imagine that public literacy is something that Elon hates, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, IMLS, which was put on a complete pause, if not people were like fired from IMLS, and that the funding itself was, at least for the last couple of years, has been either totally frozen or on the brink of just being totally decimated. I think only in the last couple of months has IMLS been sort of reinstated with funding for the next budget year, at least. But it's precarious for sure.
Okay.
And also, as long as you are in compliance with the various Trump executive orders. So like whatever your grant proposal about your library, you know, has to be de-wokeified or whatever. And also there's still quite a lot of, I mean, there's just a lot of shenanigans going on, even as they've said that the funding is reinstated. And so it's all over the map whether people have gotten their money, whether they're expecting it. As we understand it, a lot of the IMLS funding has gone to something that they're calling freedom trucks that are driving around for the U.S. 250th anniversary. And so I don't know what's in the freedom trucks, but I can guarantee that they're not books.
Yeah, really.
Or it's just like the art of the deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like National Treasure, like copies of the Constitution or something. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know as we were chatting ahead of the call, you all mentioned that the funding model looks a little bit different for public libraries versus academic libraries or something. So I don't know, Allison, did you want to expand at all on those other funding models?
You know, academic institutions, you know, quite a lot of them have endowments. Obviously, they collect tuition and things like that, but they're also subject to a similar set of political forces, I think probably maybe more significantly than like the police versus the public library. It's like the whatever college sports versus the library,
even
just the perception that libraries no longer matter and the political forces that a lot of academic institutions are succumbing to, where they're complying with the fascist imaginary without even being like physically pressured to do so. So one example is MIT has just announced that they'll be closing 3 out of 4 of their libraries. Why? MIT is so rich. You know, they have a $1 billion endowment. I'm sure it's exactly that made up amount, right? And they're also like a famous research institution. Hmm. Why would MIT close 3 of its libraries? And it's like, okay, well, think about what does the library mean versus what does the university want to signify? And I know we're going to be talking a lot about AI in this conversation, but AI and the world that AI boosters are trying to usher in is very much a part of this that says, you know, written knowledge doesn't have the significance that it used to have. What we need is just access to our phones or whatever, and we're set. We can spend the money elsewhere. Or pocket it.
Right, right. Yeah, so I mean, like you said, we will definitely get into that. But maybe by way of kind of setting the stage, one of the things you said just there is that libraries are perceived to not matter anymore. And I guess that was happening to some extent even before generative AI and kind of publicly available chatbots came along. So how have libraries kind of evolved with technology over the, you know, the last few decades? Like, how has the role of the library changed? You mentioned, of course, a few things with your providing more services, such as, for example, technical literacy. But like, how has the kind of core library changed with technology?
Something that I think of as somebody who went to library school recently, and library school is like our little fun term for going to get a master's degree in library science, which is also, just as a side note, is the way you can get upward mobility in the actual field. So just as a fun little note for listeners, we're kind of like lawyers in the way that we have to get a degree to like become a librarian, but that we're not like lawyers, and that like that doesn't really mean a lot in the sense of like there's no bar exam we have to take or whatever, but we still have to abide by some kind of accreditation program so that way we are certified in a certain way. So that's just for it's like situational context for folks for the work that we do. But I think like since libraries have become less about books that are housed physically in the library space, there have been a lot of different kinds of vendors and different kinds of companies coming in to be able to essentially like give us services to be able to have us do our job, or let us do our job rather. So like a lot of times I think like cataloging, for example, was something that happened in the library that people did in the sort of more direct way based on stuff that was coming in. But now because of just like the ubiquity of the internet and there being an ability to find information a little bit easier, copy cataloging rather, a little more common. So that's like one very slight way that has changed just from the mid 20th century into now. But I think in terms of the public computer use being like a primary pillar of what libraries provide, the thing about vendors and databases as like one of the other means of access is really important. I think also maybe too, you might have noticed maybe in the last 6 years since COVID began that like audiobooks are really popular, ebooks are really popular. These are ways that the public now accesses fiction and other kinds of titles that traditionally, I guess maybe academic libraries were really only worried about like providing journal access, and that was sort of its own thing. But now different vendors and publishers are now have these agreements that are prohibitively expensive to be able to provide audiobooks and ebooks to the public. And so that being such a large portion of how the public is accessing the library, and I think also like, you know, folks can't always go to the library in person physically. Like that is a very real limitation. It also should be not prohibitively expensive for the library to be able to provide that access. So like I said, academic libraries, I think, have tended to have this problem a little bit longer than public libraries, just in the sheer sense of like journal publishers charge a really high fee for libraries to be able to like purchase access. And that access is also not permanent, by the way. It is like subscription based. It is like seat based. So you only get so many spots for one title. So that's been a way that I've seen technology kind of change and how it's being taught to us in library school about just like you kind of just become like person with computer job still. It's not so much like depending on where you are in the library, what you do. It is not just like, okay, I have a book and I show you where the book is, which I think it is in a certain way, but you're using tools that are proprietary that are sold back to the library for us to be able to use.
Right.
Right. And this is really significant on a lot of levels, because one of the reasons why public libraries, lending libraries are able to exist is because of the copyright, the provision in U.S. copyright law called the right of first sale. So if you buy something, you are the rights holder in the sense of you can share that book with whoever you want to. This changes with digital material because the tech companies saw an opportunity to charge rents. And so we've largely moved from the ownership model that the right of first sale was predicated on to a licensing, a rentier model where the rights holders can continue extracting those rents on every library checkout. They also charge way more for library ebooks and audiobooks than what like a regular consumer would pay for them. And we've been in a prolonged fight with the big publishers around these issues, that they see libraries as threatening the possibility for future sales by offering free materials to the public.
Yeah.
How is that like compared to CDs and videos and stuff like that? Because I'm guessing that was also pre-digital, but also in this like licensing model.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, sorry, yeah, public libraries are still distribute CDs and DVDs. Definitely is something that I would say probably like budget-wise has been limited over the years as folks have gotten rid of their DVD players and CD players. I haven't, personally, because it's also just like a thing you can get from the library for free and then not have to pay the, you know, $30 for the Blu-ray or whatever. I mean, if you want to, that's great. But, you know, so that's something that I think streaming before generative AI kind of happened, I think that there's probably more literature on the subject about like how streaming, like Spotify, for example, affected people to get access to music. And then maybe that affects, I'm sure that does affect at least public libraries in particular. Yeah. Vinyl is definitely back. I know Chicago Public Library, like their downtown branch, does distribute vinyl. Like they do have vinyl you can check out, which is really cool. But yeah, so I think over time, it's definitely shifted a little bit with just like, what are the local members of the community actually looking to check out? And so over time, that does sort of come down to like, okay, maybe we don't need to purchase as many DVDs, but then we still have one copy of this versus like three copies of this. So it just happened. And then also in the Library of Things too, which I think I'll define for listeners, a Library of Things is like a thing that Allison was talking about earlier, which is just like a collection of materials that you can check out from a library that aren't like traditional books or DVDs, but they're like a boombox you can use for your block party. It's like a small equipment for gardening. It's things that are like prohibitively expensive for you to likely buy, but the library can make free for you to use for a particular period of time. So sometimes there are like DVD players within that Library of Things, which is fun. But yeah, they're definitely still around. Definitely still moving.
So AI. So we've been dancing. We've been dancing around it a bit. But I think it was you, Allison, who said this, but apologies, Kay, if it was you. Anyway, one of you said that there is this kind of perception that with the advent of generative AI or chatbots, let's say, we don't need libraries anymore. We have all of the knowledge. The robots have it. We can ask the robots questions. We get our answers. So like, why do we need libraries? Why do we need books? Why do we need any of this? So I want to just kind of throw that out. Like, what is the kind of attitude around AI that you're hearing from like your patrons, but also from your colleagues? And possibly, I don't know how libraries are actually run, but if there is a kind of administrative layer in libraries as well. So like, what's the deal with AI in libraries?
I just want to respond to one part of this first, which is, we've actually been dealing with this like disinformation campaign about libraries long before AI came into the picture. The idea that they're no longer relevant or necessary because the sum of the world's information and knowledge is now on the internet.
Right, right.
And that's like so far from true. And it becomes even less true all the time as these platforms become enshittified and they're harder and harder to find, you know, even what they were reasonably good at finding. And so AI is the next acceleration of something that we've been combating, because people with power don't want public libraries or public spaces to exist. And also they like don't know anything that's true or not true about them. So this is a form of propaganda that we are here to dissipate.
Yeah, we're spreading the anti-AI propaganda for sure. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
My patrons at my library are like, they feel like freaked out by AI. Like, they generally are like, I don't know, this is a thing that I'm being told I should know how to use, and like, can you help me to understand like what I need to know? I'll also say too, like, I've done a ton of programming at my library around like, what is AI? Like, what is the history behind this? Who is impacted by these technologies? Trying to ingratiate patrons into the material conditions of what the technology is, which ends up being a bigger discussion about how, like Allison is saying, this is not a new conversation, but especially for folks who are non-library workers, for example, who are just like looking at their phone all day or like looking at the news all day and are just like, Anthropic has this big sale and OpenAI is doing this. Like, people are, they need help to understand like beyond just the hype and just the sheer framing of what like news organizations are saying about what AI is. So that's one thing I'll say. Yeah.
Can we send like CEOs to the library to talk to you for some of this education? Because they seem to be.
We can send them somewhere else that I can't say can on the recording.
Yeah.
Please don't send them to us.
No, please. Yeah. We can have our admin talk to them, I guess. And yeah, whatever. But so patrons, I mean, I think like some of them, they do think that it is a tool that they can use. Like, they do frame it as a tool. And it's frustrating to just have that interaction with folks at the reference desk, because it communicates to us that they don't know exactly like what services we have to offer to give to them. Like, most of the time they're just asking for access to a database that we already pay money for the library to provide. So they're also looking for, just for context, I've seen patrons come in and ask us questions about how to use a tool, quote unquote, like ChatGPT, to create legal documents or like create resumes or things that they need to access other things like social services or getting a job, things that are like consequential to their survival, they feel like they have to use this chatbot. So we're kind of glad that they're coming to us in some capacity. Like, we're like, great, like, cool, we can have this interaction. We can talk about what this actually means for you. And then they sometimes come in for other programs that are like, what is the hype of all this stuff? Depending on the patron's capacity, they might like be at different points in that interaction, depending on like kind of what's going on with themselves, like in terms of just like, what are their needs? Are their basic needs getting met? And then that way we can kind of move forward towards like the bigger picture dialogue stuff. But in terms of other library workers, it's very contentious. There's a lot of disagreement in the field about what AI even is, what it is, should or should not be used for, and whether or not it is our place to step in to this dynamic. So a lot of discussions, particularly between like library workers who are not management, who are not administrators, who are just like, I don't want to use this tool. This is like making my day-to-day worse. I have to clean up all the slop that my admin is putting out with Gemini or whatever. And that's just posing more, it's creating more work for people who are already burnt out, who are already overworked and underpaid. And so it's not taken in well by most people, I would say. And Allison and I can talk about the survey that Library Freedom Project did to this effect recently to try to graph, like, what are library workers even feeling about AI? Like, how do they feel the impacts? Because a lot of the surveys that have been given out within the field have been very pro AI, very like interested in adoption, very assuming that people are using the tools. And also that a lot of these institutions, like universities in particular, are partnering with OpenAI and like Anthropic. And like, so there are contracts in place to effectively enforce use of a tool. And so it's trickling down to library workers. Library administrators and consultants tend to be more pro AI, obviously, because that's where the sort of the money is, quote unquote, at the moment. And there is a lot of condescension coming down from this sort of, I wouldn't call them the ruling class necessarily, but it feels that way, like in the sense of just like, we are being sort of told like, you must do this or else. And sort of like, what is that or else? Like, does this mean that you're going to keep eliminating our jobs, keep underpaying us, keep like sort of dispelling possibilities for unionization? Like, what does this mean? So there's a lot of interest in having us also be the cheerleaders of this technology. Like, they really want us to be the ones to interject, which again is reinforcing the narrative of like, we must do everything, I guess. And something that I find just really disgusting is just like this idea that like we can reasonably be the ones to like change what ChatGPT is. Like, it's just like, we can't prompt our way out of austerity. Like, this is stupid. Like, I don't really understand why there is this emphasis from, at least from people up top who are just assuming that like, because we do information technology and that we work with the public, that like we are the ones who are culpable if something then is disentangled with the public's understanding of information and technology. Like, so there's this weird dynamic of like, if we don't teach patrons how to use ChatGPT, they're not going to be able to get a job. And therefore, like, we're sort of deconstructing society by not doing this. I find that really abhorrent. So that's just my little soapbox. But I just, it is really tricky to be in these rooms and also like try to navigate the interests of like emotionally, just like in the room of like interpersonally of just like, it's a very charged subject. And so something that I think I'm focusing a lot of my scholarship on right now is just like, how do we navigate these like visceral feelings of disgust? How do we break through that and actually like build political power instead of just being like, you, I don't like you, like, let's move away. Like, because there's better things we can be doing instead of just like having consultants talk down to us about, I don't know, how like the water usage of a data center is like not worse than like red meat consumption or whatever. And so like, we shouldn't really care. Like, there's a lot of that false equivocations happening, but
yeah.
But yeah.
So Allison, then tell us about this survey. Like, what was it and what were the findings? Because that sounds really interesting.
So we put it out last year, September, October, and it was essentially kind of a response to what Kay mentioned, that we just kept, you know, we have an internal Discord for LFP members, and people would be constantly sharing, like, I got another AI hype survey. And, you know, they're basically push polls. They're like, tell us your favorite thing about AI. You know, it's that kind of stuff, right? It's like, it assumes use, it assumes enthusiasm, and they just want to show that sort of thing. And so we created our own, and we made our skeptical position very clear. And we were like, you know, we want to know what issues you have with this. And so we asked a number of things. We asked about what areas of concern people had. We asked about the impact on their own labor, the impact on their patrons, and a few other things. But those are sort of the most substantial areas. The areas of concern, we listed most of the kind of major ethical issues that are talked about by skeptics and haters, you know, climate impacts, misinformation, false information of various kinds, impacts on labor, etc. And every category, more than the majority of response. Well, first of all, we got close to 600 responses. That screwed us up a little bit because we were like, oh, we thought we would get maybe 100 responses. We got bombarded with responses. And then we realized that we don't really know how to do surveys. And so it took us a really long time to code all these qualitative answers. We're like, what am I supposed to do with this? So we're writing out the analysis now to be published soon, maybe by the time this podcast airs. But what we learned was, you know, that our colleagues have enormous concerns that are unaddressed. And even those people who signaled some kind of, at least like maybe ambiguity or some measure of like, well, I find this technology to be useful, they still say that their concerns are pretty major. And the biggest concern areas were those that mapped onto library work. So mis- and disinformation, the impacts on overall information literacy and critical thinking and curiosity. The impacts on our own labor were a lot of things that Kay talked about. People talked so much about how, like, their boss now says, you have to make AI part of your job. I don't care what it is. I don't even know what AI is when I say that, but now it's a deliverable, and you have to show the admin and the board that you're incorporating it somehow. And that, you know, and like, to be clear, we've seen this sort of like administrative consultant class, like FOMO driven tech adoption in the past in library world. We're actually highly susceptible to it because we are so underfunded and we're so desperate for even, you know, let alone the resources we need, even just the resources to get us to a functional level where we need to be meeting our patrons' basic needs, that we're way more willing to accept a bunch of bullshit from tech companies or their kind of thinking or propaganda, because we're so afraid that if we don't do this thing, we're going to be even more left behind than we are with very little funding. And especially arguments that propagandize around things like cost saving, you know, oh, AI is going to save you money, or this technology is going to save you money or labor. Those are very seductive to library administrators, and especially library boards, who quite often they're in a governing kind of role, and yet none of them have a library background. They're all like local real estate developers or some other kind of schmuck, right? But yeah, so the impact on library work is it's making our jobs worse, and there is quite a lot of ambient fear that library workers have that this thing is coming for their jobs, whether that means that they will lose their job or whether it means just more of what it has been already, which is greater demands on their labor with no additional compensation or time. And so AI, as we have seen many, many times over again now, is it's a tool of the bosses to extract more from the working class. The impact on our patrons is also manifold. It's a lot of the things that Kay already mentioned. It's a lot of confusion from our patrons, a lot of wariness, a lot of, you know, the inevitability propaganda having consumed them thinking, well, I don't like this thing. I don't think it works, but I'm being told that if I don't use it, I'm going to fall behind. And especially, I think we see this impacting our marginalized patrons. So folks that have like lower income or lower levels of education, they are the ones who are told the most that they have to adopt and adapt or they'll die. And we also saw in the survey a lot of really troubling things about patrons sharing increased misinfo. So we were already in a misinformation and literacy crisis prior to the AI explosion. Now we're seeing patrons who are like, hey, will you find me this book or this citation? And it's something that has been completely hallucinated by whatever chatbot they've spoken to. Or even worse than that, that it's like shifting their beliefs. They're seeing the phenomena that's being called AI psychosis developing in a lot of community members. But on the bright side, we also saw in this survey, and what we've seen a lot in our own work, is that there is an enormous appetite among the public and among library workers for different narratives, for a counter narrative, for materials to resist this environment. And so that's what we've really been trying to take up in Library Freedom Project, is creating resources. If you go to our website, you'll see a bunch of stuff that's like, hey, here's how to get rid of all that AI cruft that is on the platform that you know, used to work this way. Here's how to get rid of the stuff as much as you're able to. We also include, even in those sort of like very individual focused resources, we're like, you know, this shouldn't be your problem. So you may be interested in hearing about your local data center fight or whatever. And so we try to funnel people into more possibility. And there's sometimes some trickiness in the library world because we have, you know, a lot of obligations to different kinds of objectivity, et cetera. But the good news about telling people off about AI is that all you need to do is present the facts. Yeah. We're just telling you how it actually works. We're just telling you who owns it and what they said about it. And, you know, you can form your own opinion. Maybe you can tell what my opinion is, but I'm not actually just trying to manipulate you here. I'm just sharing what is real.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I definitely want to get into the resistance angle, but just a couple of quick questions based on, you know, what you've said there. So since one of the things libraries are doing is providing access to computers to the public, for example, are libraries also like providing access to AI to the public? Like, do you have subscriptions to this stuff?
It's like possible. I think at least in my library, it is definitely being used by staff. We, meaning the staff, I'm not using it, but there is Gemini built into Google Suite people are using. And I want to be very clear to listeners that if you prompt stuff into Gemini, that stuff can be FOIA'd. That can be like actually grasped by public information bodies. FOIA'd, for non-US listeners, is the Freedom of Information Act that says that you can submit requests for access to public information from public institutions. So prompting into Gemini is something that can absolutely be FOIA'd. So that's like very intense, right? In terms of providing patrons access, I think that there is a model, at least right now, of like, we are tasked with helping patrons to use it if they have their own account with something, if they bring in their own laptops, for example, and they show us and they have questions about it. But at least in my library, there isn't a push, thankfully, yeah, hopefully never, but about not having that be a part of our budget to actually like accommodate that cost. But every library is different. Depending on who's running it, they may be really interested in like buying a bunch of tokens for people to use, whether it's for internal staff use or for external patron use. You know, it's really expensive. Even tech companies are having a hard time affording this kind of cost. So I don't know if we will exactly see that as like something that library admin will reasonably do in the near future, from my just like pragmatic guess. But I do also know that in doing research about data centers and the tech companies that are purporting community benefits funds like Microsoft and Meta, for example, they very much want to see a like Gemini, or they want to see Copilot, like a Copilot kiosk in the library. So they want to see that stuff happen in like in press releases. So whether that will actually happen is sort of to find out, I guess, but we don't necessarily include that in a budget line for now, and I hope to God never.
Yeah, but I guess the point is that it's creating a permission structure
Yeah.
for people to get access to it. But for library workers, then, if you're using, you know, if you can be FOIA'd for the ChatGPT use, then that, I guess that means that also that either the admin or the companies themselves are surveilling the workers.
There's definitely ways for information technology departments within a library to track what people are doing on their work computers. So depending on what library you work in and like how chill your IT department is, they may or may not be doing that already.
The reason I mention it here, just to add to that, is that in programming environments, what happens is that developers will get access to like Copilot or Claude or whatever, and they'll get access to it through some sort of system that mm-hmm. the company has. And then the company IT department or the company management can review people's usage of the tech to make, you know, essentially to say, have you spent your tokens, or how many times have you accepted the AI answers and stuff like this?
Yeah.
That's what I mean by like surveilling, because, you know, that I don't know if that's something that's done for you guys.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that I've heard of, that, you know, depending on whether the information is like made explicit to staff members, I don't know if that's always the case, but I know that in IT departments, like, I mean, they can look at your web history. Like, that is something that, like, for the possibility of being FOIA'd, they are at least surveilling that to a certain degree. Whether or not they actively check what you're doing on the computer while you're actually at work is a different conversation, I think, but there is definitely some kind of gathering of that data internally. Whether or not to sort of figure out, like, is this, I mean, I guess in a utilitarian way, is this useful, or to see like who is using it this much, then that way they can sort of discern, especially when, I guess in the sense of like who would be FOIA'd, there's just different conversations there. But I think in a lot of cases, like, they do track the information just for the sake of the law in the US.
So then resistance, I think that's a really important topic. And Allison, you mentioned some of the acts of resistance you're trying to promote and educate people about. How do you see this playing out in libraries with library workers, but also perhaps the patrons themselves? What acts of resistance do you see happening, and how successful are those?
Well, I think one of the first things that I want to start with is something we've talked about a lot already, which is just the amount of propaganda that exists from the AI hype world. While it is really encouraging that there's a great deal of resistance and refusal, investigative journalism, and really good work being done on the counter narrative, that there is a dominant mainstream position that is very infectious, that's like, blah, blah, inevitability, blah, blah, it's just going to get better and better. And so what a lot of our response in Library Freedom Project and the work that we've been doing around refusal is combating that propaganda machine. And it's so much of what, like, a lot of the problems that we're having, you know, a lot of our patron views on this stuff, even our colleagues who are, you know, maybe not the ones who are, well, no, certainly the ones who are most hype driven, but the ones who are a little bit like, I don't love this, but I feel like I need to do it. What they need is a really strong counter narrative. And so that's what a lot of our work is focused on. We call it critical AI literacy. And it's basically like, we're here to break down like the tech company PR document. What do they say? What do they mean? What is actually possible? Kaya said this several times in this conversation, but like, what are we even talking about when we say AI? Can we be more specific about the technical capabilities? Which ones are new and which ones are not new? And then focusing on some of the areas that we identified in our survey that are of the greatest need. So one, we have a whole critical AI literacy series that we offer to libraries. We can either come in and teach it to their patrons, we can teach it to their staff, or we can do some combination of both. And we cover things like how to identify if something is AI generated or not, you know, going through some of the common scams and how to train yourself to be a little bit more cognizant or vigilant about those things, understanding things like local energy use, or going beyond even energy use, other local impacts, like how to find out if your local government is in procurement with some AI company, like how are they using Copilot? How are they talking to data center developers, things like that. Also understanding some of the bigger climate issues. And so we have a whole series of this programming that we offer for libraries. We also have, as I mentioned already, a ton of stuff on our website that we've worked on collaboratively that is responsive to our patron and colleagues' needs. So something that's cool about having a collective of, like, we have around 200 members now. We're constantly in dialogue about, like, all the things that Kay was talking about. We're like, I heard this from a patron today. Here's what we need to create in response. So a lot of our refusal materials came from those conversations. People just want to know how to turn the stuff off. A number of our members are running these classes in their libraries. And an important thing to note here is that those programs are doing gangbusters. In every single community, if you offer a program that's like, here's how to resist incursion of AI into your life, people will sign up for it so fast. We've observed this in all different kinds of communities, from one of our members who's in somewhat rural Maine to one who is here in Philly who just started offering some programs. People will show up to them. So we're doing a lot of that kind of, like, community building and development, and also just providing resources for library workers who are maybe the lonely voice of dissent in their library, helping them with things like talking points, other ways that they can throw a wrench in the gears. You know, there's a lot of great work being done on, like, labor power against AI, contract language, and that sort of thing. But a lot of it, for what we've found out, is like, if you can give the one loud dissenting person some good material to work with, they will very soon find out that there's actually, like, 10 other people that they work with who also agree, but just didn't have the language for it. And so a lot of it is kind of leadership development as well.
Yeah.
That definitely resonates with me as well. Like, especially in the programming community, I would say that the overwhelming timbre of the dialogue is positive, right? This AI is amazing. You know, I'm so much more productive. And, you know, I've personally felt extremely lonely. You know, am I the only person out here that doesn't like this stuff? And, you know, so I imagine, or I can understand rather, how, like, empowering it is to find out, first of all, well, here's this organization that is definitely on my side, giving me some ammunition, basically. And guess what? There are a bunch of other people that feel the same way I do. And this is what makes the inevitability narrative so infuriating. The only reason it's going to be inevitable is because we've all convinced ourselves it's going to be, right? And we forget to fight. But really quickly, you mentioned labor power. And Kay, you said something earlier about unionization. I'm just wondering, like, are library workers typically in unions? How does that work?
I would say it's becoming a stronger movement in libraries. It is really dependent, again, on the institution that you work in. Like, in Illinois, I think there's a number of folks who are part of AFL-CIO and AFSCME. You know, at least in Chicago, I know the American Library Association's staff just actually ratified their contract, I believe, or they were like, I forget what point they are in the process, but the new director of ALA, like, staff-wise, is a big union guy, and so they also just got into a union process. Traditionally, this goes back to the idea of a conception as a worker within librarianship is still really new in the last maybe 20 years or so. Before, and there's a couple of articles on this, namely by the late Fobazi Atare, who passed away in the last year, who wrote about this term called vocational awe,
right,
which is basically this idea that library workers in, you know, pre-2000, I would say, but definitely has persists currently. But by and large, because the majority of librarians were middle-class white women who were, like, kind of tasked with something to do with the local library versus, like, pursuing it as a professional career, there's this view of librarianship as a virtuistic and religious sort of calling, or it's a mission. And this myth has persisted throughout librarianship for decades and decades and still is around today. So part of the worker conversation definitely comes into play when we now conceive of ourselves as workers and as laborers versus just, like, I don't know, missionaries or people sent from God or whatever. This is, like, again, kind of going back into the discussion of, like, library workers in the 21st century are a little more keen on considering ourselves within the purview of labor, but historically, especially the makeup of the field is mostly white. It is mostly people who are women. This is like a dynamic that I think is shifting over the last years, but I think it's like 86% of the field is white. That's across the whole country of the United States. So it is particularly our point of refusal must come from this particular like social and political point that it is our desire to our meeting the field's desire to care about AI in this particular way comes from whiteness. It comes from thinking that like we can save people with technology. And it has to, there's a lot to say, I think, about just like the white saviorism aspect of this that I think is really dark and really, I think, really pervasive. So that's in terms of unionizing, I think we're getting there. And I think it's more and more popular every day. In fact, I think the ALA put out a book recently about how to organize your library, which is great.
Wow.
Emily Drabinsky, who is the president of the American Library Association last year, 2 years ago, also does a lot of like labor organizing work as well. So there is a desire for it within librarianship, but it is not quite the same as teachers, I would say. It's not quite to that level just yet, but I think we're seeing it more and more for sure.
So what can we as members of the public, I mean, especially, I guess, our listeners in the United States, which is not me and Ray, and actually now I'm really curious about how libraries work in, you know, my country. So I'm going to go find out. But how can the general public support libraries kind of in general, but more specifically support you in your resistance against not only AI, but kind of the big tech project to, you know, maybe steal knowledge away from all of us?
I think supporting libraries is remarkably easy. You simply get a library card and you use it. That, I mean, just as a starting point, right? Do you have a library card? A lot of people like to say that they support libraries and they don't actually have a library card. Go there and ask them, tell me something that I don't know about what I can get at the library. And you're going to find out about all kinds of the things that Kay and I have spoken on today. I think that there's also a lot of avenues for even more kind of political activation in support of libraries. So like find out what the budget fight is like. Find out if there is a property tax levy to support library funding. There's an amazing project called Libraries for the People, which is organizing people with left politics to join library boards in the US. So library boards... Yeah. There's some that are advisory boards. There are some that are governing boards. There are some that are appointed. There are some that are elected. But in any of those situations, it's a locus. It's a form of local power that we can take. And also typically is one that right now is held by a lot of enemies. The right in the US, part of the reason that they've had success around their broad censorship efforts is that they've taken over library boards. Now, the good news is that like anytime people get organized against them, they lose miserably. And so if you have some time to volunteer getting involved with your library board or even just going to a board meeting, Libraries for the People has some really great resources on like, okay, if you go to a board meeting, here's what you should get up and say. Find out what's on the agenda and like, talk to your local librarian and ask them what would be helpful for you as a patron to go and speak on, because librarians are in this tricky position sometimes where like, you know, we work for those municipalities. It's harder for us to take a political stance.
Right,
and so find out what your library worker needs to have said on their behalf. And in terms of supporting our work in Library Freedom Project, I mean, all of those things are supportive of our work because we are librarians. But if anybody listening has any money, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we will take your tax-deductible donation.
Excellent.
Kay, do you have anything to add?
I think, yeah, echoing Allison, I mean, just get a library card, go to your library in person if you can. Library budgets really rely on like door count for programs and just being there. Your presence, just being in the space is enough. Checking out the books is even better. Going to programs is even better. yeah, talking to library staff, asking them what they need, finding out if you have a, if there's a foundation for the library as well, or like if there's like a Friends of sort of separate body that does a lot of support. So like, for example, a lot of libraries will do like a book sale and they'll raise money for the library through like a Friends of or a foundation. And that money is can be put towards non-operating things, but like really helps for like materials or equipment or buying books or like, you know, getting rehabbing shelving or being able to helping to pay for, I don't know, even like sustainability measures, like trying to get solar on your library or trying to make sure air conditioning is a little more efficient, that kind of thing. There are absolutely ways where you can get involved, even if you don't have all of the like know-how about what libraries are and what they do. Just going there and also like making an effort to go, like say if you're a parent and you go to the library for story time, telling other parents like, hey, you can just go there as an adult. That's okay. Yeah. you can be there.
Yeah.
It's not just for kids and teens and people who are retired. Like you can certainly be there and make your presence known. And if there are programs that you're like, I want to see this at night or whatever, like just talk to staff. Like there are ways that we can make the library work better for you. And within what we can do, and that you can also absolutely be supportive in that way as an individual person. And even if also quickly, I'll just add that something that I would think is a really cool point of advocacy would be to try to like reduce any limitations between what cardholders in a library can access. So trying to communicate to the library board, I think these services should be open to all people who are locally available and not just people who have a card. To get a library card, you need to have some proof of address, typically some place that you own as property or as a place that you rent from. Or even if you work in the area, you might be able to qualify for a library card. The more barriers that can be reduced to access in that way, I think is really, really important. And it broadens services for people who may or may not be able to live in a certain area. Particularly in the United States, like more affluent suburbs and more affluent places tend to have better funded libraries. And so those are spaces that like, if there's a place near there that is not as higher income, those folks absolutely are coming to that library to visit for better access to resources and a space to be. So limiting the access for cardholder only, it's imperative that we open up access to people at that particular juncture, I think.
Yeah, weaponize your position. Like if you're a taxpayer in that locality, say, as a taxpayer, I'm cool with my taxes going to be spent on people who don't live here. I love to, whenever I'm like calling my local legislators or whatever, I'm like, as a small business owner, business owner and a taxpayer, use that and defend the library with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering before we kind of like wrap this up a little bit, I'm wondering if what's your kind of vibe, if you like, from the patrons and from the workers around this stuff in terms of the resistance that you're already kind of like, you know, sort of doing at the moment. You know, I think it's great to have these other things as well, but what's the kind of current situation in terms of the vibe?
I mean, I think it's a lot of what we were speaking on a little earlier, that like the vibes are pretty bad with regard to how people are taking this stuff in. But when they find out about the work that we're doing and they see that they're not alone, even if they're very isolated, that there's other people in the library field who are paying attention and like really fighting back on these issues, it can have a pretty generative effect. And so I mean, a lot of what we try to do is just bring people together to have opportunities to like collaborate and work on these things towards the future, because we believe that a better future is possible.
Fantastic.
What an awesome point.
You got it.
Yeah, I mean, vocational, I know that's not what it means, but I at least am in awe of your vocation. So, thanks for that. So before we sign off, is there any kind of last thing that you would like to say that you think is important for people to know?
I don't know. Read a book.
Yeah.
Reading books is hard, but don't let print literacy go away.
Yeah, you can spend the time that off your phone. Like you can stop scrolling and just like open up a book. Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's words that we all needed to hear, I'm sure.
Everyone I know has had a harder time of reading since COVID. You just have to just look at the page. When you want to look away, don't. Just keep looking at it.
It's so simple.
It's so simple.
Yeah.
Just keep looking at it.
I guess people could pick up a manga as well.
It's a book. It's all books.
It's a book. Yeah. Audiobooks count too, for sure. Yeah. Audiobooks are books. And I want people to read in print.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. This has been a fascinating conversation, actually very motivating as well. So thank you both for that. Thank you for the work that you do as well. And, you know, most of all, thank you for coming on and talking to us.
Yeah, this is absolutely fantastic.
Thanks for having us. This is fun.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!